Hi, everybody. Good evening. Welcome to Evoke Therapy Program's broadcast. My name is Dr. Brad Reedy, and today is Wednesday, October 30th, 2019. I think this is going to be quite an interesting topic because it really does blend together several of the things that I've talked about in the past. Tonight, we're talking about the idea of how expectations of perceived success are affecting young people today, adolescents and young adults. And we're going to look at it from a few different angles. But I thought we'd start off with something a little bit fun to give some perspective, or a little bit different to give some perspective. There is an idea about children today that I think that things are drastically different or worse than they've been in previous generations. And I always think about this idea that wouldn't it be nice if for the first time in many generations, we didn't make the mistake of believing that everything was worse. And I think sometimes we think about that. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that tonight also. I have some quotes that I want to share with you. The first one, we live in a decaying age. Young people no longer respect their parents. They are rude and impatient. They frequently inhabit bars and have no self-control. Quote number two, what is happening to our young people? They disrespect their elders. They disobey their parents. They ignore the law. They riot in the streets, inflamed with wild notions. Their morals are decaying. What's become of them? The children now love luxury. They have bad manners, contempt for authority, and show disrespect to their elders. They no longer rise when elders enter the room. They contradict their parents, chatter before company, and are tyrants over their teachers. And then the young people of today think of nothing but themselves. They have no reverence for parents or old age. They are impatient of all restraint. They talk as if they alone knew everything, and what passes for wisdom with us is foolishness with them. As for girls, they are forward, immodest, and unworthy of speech, behavior, and dress. A couple more. Because now that anyone is free to post whatever they wish, they often disregard that which is best and instead write what would be best forgotten. And even when they write something worthwhile, they twist it and corrupt it to the point where it would be much better to do without such sights rather than spreading falsehoods over the whole world. Experts warn of information overload. This overabundance is confusing and harmful, they say, to the mind. They've urged governments to regulate and limit its use. Now, the irony is these are all very old quotes. Those last quotes about publishing, about posting, were actually about the press. So we think about the idea of the printing press now is old-fashioned, even outdated, but at the time that it came out, people had the same ideas about that they do about the internet today. It was Conrad Gesser in the 1500s who warned about information overload, and it was Niccolo Pirati in the 1400s that warned about the printing press. So I thought it'd give, in kind of a fun way, gave us some perspective. Some of those other quotes are 6,000 years old, Plato, Socrates, the 13th century. So there's this idea, I think, that we think in each generation. Douglas Adams has this idea about technology and our reaction to it. He said, anything that is in the world when you're born is normal and ordinary, is just a natural part of the way that the world works. Anything that's invented before when you're 15 and 35 is new and exciting and revolutionary, and you can probably get a career in it. And then anything invented after you're 35 is against the natural order of things. So sometimes I think we have an overreaction. And there's something in psychology called negative bias. And negative bias is our brain, the human brain's response to stimuli, that we're going to pay attention to negative things more than positive things. And it's an evolutionary principle, because think about it this way. If we miss, as a species, if we miss a perceived threat, the possibility is death, and you don't get to pass along your genes. But if you miss something positive, like a meal or low-hanging fruit, you live for another day. So our brains are wired to pay attention to and to seek out and to record negative more than positive. And I think we can do that. I think especially when there's an overload of that kind of trauma, either because of our own past and our own childhood, or because of the things that our children expose us to, the trauma that we're exposed to by our children's behavior. I think that that kind of trauma can build up and we can have a hair trigger, if it were, in terms of our reactions to our children and to the information that we get. There definitely are rising suicide rates. We're seeing mental health issues rise since 1950. It's almost, the suicide rates for adolescents is almost quadrupled. The problems that we see in our culture seem to be disproportionate. Many families considered affluent, smart, well-off, motivated parents are still having troubles with their children and their mental health. So some of this I took from, I'm going to take this from several different sources this evening. And this first part comes from Madeline Levine. And she went looking for the answer. She had a private practice in the Bay Area in Marin County. And she wrote the book, The Price of Privilege. And that's where some of this information, this first information comes from. She talked about looking over her caseload at the end of the week and wondering why adolescents are struggling to come in their life when they're coming from affluent families and communities. How might affluence, and she defines affluence as opportunity, contribute to mental health symptoms? Why are girls 3 times more likely to have depression if they come from an affluent family? 2 factors repeatedly emerge as she explored them as contributing to their high levels of emotional problems. The first is achievement pressure, and the second is a disconnection or an isolation from parents. So, because of the pressure that we feel, because of the competitive nature of our communities, and this is not new information to all of you. You live in these communities. You're subject to these kinds of pressures and judgments. We're thinking about success in terms of academic and financial for our children from the youngest of ages, right? Worrying about in preschool, the timeline or the narrative that our child is going to go through in their developmental stages to get into an Ivy League school. And they're carrying that pressure, that idea, that anxiety that we have. In terms of performance, she says, kids are bombarded with messages about the importance of high performance at school, at home, and in the media. Social media is exposing them to it. What they really need is to be educated about the values of perseverance and perspective, and to understand that learning and performance are not always the same thing. They need to see that their parents value effort, curiosity, and intellectual courage. One of the most important things that I think should be taught in every parenting class, that we should have been taught in high school, was that when we value kids' giftedness, their potential, we put a certain amount of expectation on them that can be crippling for them. But if we value effort, if we value perseverance, then we value something that they have control over. They don't have control over necessarily their potential. That just is. They don't have control over their genetic loading. That's not within their control. But what they do have control over is their effort and their perseverance. And even though I know this, and I know this now, I wish I'd learned it younger. I wish I'd learned it when I was raising my 2 older children who are in their mid-20s. Even though I know this now with my 2 younger children that are in their teens and preteens, I still slip into that place of praising their potential, of praising their giftedness. Parents who persistently fall on the side of intervening for their children, as opposed to supporting their child's attempts to problem solve, interfere with the most important task of childhood and adolescence, the development of the sense of self, that's a key piece. And it's really, really difficult. It requires us to do some healing around our own unfinished business and what I would call, what therapists would call a trauma response. We have a heightened fight or flight mentality response to things. And so it's difficult for us to go through what I call empathic misery, empathic pain. So we want to relieve that in our children, even though intellectually we can understand of the value in it, letting our children struggle, letting them feel something uncomfortable. I know this as much as all of you, maybe more because I studied all the time and I still profoundly struggle it as much as any parent does some days. One of the things that I've spent a lot of my time in my career doing is really helping parents embrace the journey and the detours on the journey, the ups and downs, the mistakes on the journey. it's a very difficult thing, but we can develop a practice of saying to our children, of responding to our children as they make mistakes, that we trust the process. We can have less of an emotional reaction to it. But when we get triggered by mistakes, by setbacks, that can load very heavily on our children. As I get more and more experience and exposure to children that struggle, I've learned that my bandwidth in this area has increased. And I think for a lot of parents that we work with at Evoke, that's one of the things that we're trying to encourage, to teach, to facilitate, is increasing bandwidth. If you react with anxiety, with pain, I call it kind of the parental gasp, right? That kind of worry feeling when your child comes to you with a problem or with a mistake, there's one thing that they immediately know, and that's that you're not safe. And we want to be a resource to our children, so we learn to take it in stride. One of the reasons why having an outside person like a therapist help your child is that we have an advantage over you. If your child came to me telling me about a mistake, maybe even that they were cutting on themselves, for example, is the example that I like to use because that can be very triggering for a parent. If your child comes to me and shares that with me, my response is going to be curious, much more often than not. But if my own child comes to me with that same story, that same behavior, that same symptom, it's a lot harder for me to contain it, to respond with a non-trauma response. We have to resist the temptation to soothe with things, right? To try to make it better. And while that might have a payoff in reducing our own anxiety, it doesn't teach the child to go through their own anxiety, to sit with discomfort, and it suggests that the feelings need to go away. It's important, especially at Evoke, especially in all of these treatment programs that you're at Evoke and after Evoke, that you give opportunities and lean into the struggles and the failures when the stakes are low. Right? We want our children to fail when the stakes are low and to have that practice. In describing parenting and the intrusive nature that we sometimes get engaged in, Dr. Levine says that intrusion and support are two fundamentally different processes. Support is about the needs of the child, and intrusion is about the needs of the parent. And that's a very simple way to understand it. And it takes work, and it takes practice, and it takes feedback to develop that perspective. And it takes time. I was just in Chicago with a group of parents, and one of the parents shared what I think to be a fundamental idea in this journey when he said, it is a lifelong journey. It is a transformation that takes months and years. Getting on the journey offers hope in the immediate, but to realize that this is a lifelong journey. I've been at it for 26 years now. And while I can clearly see improvements over those 26 years, it's painstakingly slow for me. But I'm hopeful because, not because I've completed the journey, I'm hopeful because I know what the project is. I know the project is to work on me and not the child. I love this idea. This comes from the book Nurture Shock. Shifting to sources here. I love the idea about praise. Like I said, this is one of those concepts about praise that I think all young parents and even high school students should be taught. This idea that, sure, he's special, but new research suggests that if you tell the child that, you'll ruin him. It's a neurobiological fact. Children that get told that they are gifted struggle when they fail. They struggle. They're more likely to choose easier tasks, to avoid something challenging, or to cheat. Think about that. Children that are told that they are gifted are more likely to quit, to avoid difficult tasks, or to cheat, because what's at risk for them is that station of giftedness. I want to talk about some of the research on grit from Angela Lee Duckworth. She studied and tried to predict success. She studied cadets at West Point. She studied teachers that taught where there were rough demographics. She worked with students in Chicago. And what she identified was that passion and perseverance were present for very long-term goals. She described stamina, right? This ability to rebound. This idea of, I'm going to be talking about tonight, the growth mindset. The growth mindset versus the fixed mindset is the idea that a person comes to understand that their neural pathways are plastic and can change. Whereas a fixed mindset suggests you either have it or you don't. And that students that are instructed in the growth mindset, not just treated that way, but are actually taught about the growth mindset, score better on academic tests in math and even in other areas than students who have more math instruction. So just learning about how the brain works improves a student's ability to learn math. That is incredibly powerful. Learning to teach children about neuroplasticity, learning to teach them and reinforce the idea that life is like a marathon and not a sprint, that talent does not equate to grit, are all keys. Teaching kids about how the brain changes increases the likelihood of perseverance. There's a lot of research around that I'm going to be talking about tonight about math, because this is actually where it started. Because there's a cultural idea that you either have math, you have a math brain, or you don't, right? Many people will say, I'm just not a math person. But the fact of the matter is that that's not true, and that children that are told that they are gifted in math sometimes struggle with severe anxiety. They have to learn that failure is a part of the journey and that their brain can change and grow as they go. And that paying attention to these things in the growth mindset, these attributes instead of giftedness, are predictors of resilience and grit. There's some studies that Carol Dweck did where she gave praise to children after a test for either effort or being smart, like I mentioned earlier. And 90% of the effort praise chose a more challenging test, while less than 50% of the smart praise children chose the more challenging test. Emphasizing effort gives the child a variable that they can control. They come to see themselves as in control of their success. Emphasizing natural intelligence, on the other hand, takes it out of the child's control and provides no good recipe for responding to a failure. Again, I think that we have thought, I know I have thought about praising children because I thought that would give them confidence, right? It's counterintuitive. And it took me a long time to recognize this idea and to understand this idea, and I still struggle with it. Thomas, one father says, didn't want to try the things that he wouldn't be successful at. His father said some things came very quickly to him, but when they didn't, he gave up almost immediately, concluding, I'm not good at this. With no more than a glance, Thomas was dividing the world into two things. He was naturally good at things or he wasn't. That's the idea of the fixed mindset. But with the growth mindset, Dr. Dweck coined the terms fixed mindset and growth mindset to describe the underlying beliefs that people have about learning and intelligence. When students believe that they can get smarter, they understand that effort makes them stronger. Therefore, they put in extra time and effort, and that leads to higher achievement. Now while I'm talking about this in the context of simply of academics, later on we understood that this applies to pro-social behaviors also. Seventh graders who were taught that intelligence is malleable and show how the brain grows with effort showed a clear increase in math grades, while those who, like I said, had more math instructions did not do as well. You can go to mindsetworks.com to learn more. In addition to academic ability, students may develop a fixed mindset about their personal characteristics. Yeager and colleagues found that students who participated in a 6-lesson intervention about the malleability of their personality traits behaves less aggressively and more pro-socially. This research demonstrated that we can change student mindsets in non-academic areas and make an impact on the range of behaviors. All of this is the same kind of idea. We create or foster a certain kind of fragility when we hold on tightly to this idea of gifted and success is something that you're born with. When we stress the importance of failure, I read this story on social media some time ago about the CEO from Spanx, that's that clothing company. And we won't talk about that at length, but she described that when she was growing up that her father would every night ask the children around the dinner table what they had failed at that day. And if they didn't have something they had failed at, he would kind of act disappointed. And what he was teaching them over time was that it's important to fail, it's important to try, and that he valued the success. Carl Jung used to say that about his clients. The great psychologist would say when a client would come in with a setback or a failure, he would metaphorically toast a glass of champagne to them, suggest, you know, this is fantastic. This is a great opportunity. And then when they experience some success, he would say, well, if we hunker down and pool together, we can really get through this. Kind of reshifting the idea between about failure and success. Resilience is more related to a sense of self. The biggest shift, I think, in parenting is when we shift to raising good something or others, to raising healthy selves. So many children who describe intense anxiety or often depression, who make suicide attempts, will describe the level of expectation that they feel that nobody intentionally put on them. But they're applying some unrealistic measure to themselves. They're creating this binary world of pass and fail. And there's no real sense of self. Success is more valuable than figuring out who you are. It was one parent who said to his daughter, he said, I'm okay with you making your own choices as long as they're the right ones. And while he was trying to be funny, there was a lot of truth in the way that he treated his daughter. So when we help children develop a sense of self instead of success, we become curious about who they are and how they feel, about what they don't like and what they do like, about their goals and values, desires and preferences, right? It becomes a response to them. And then again, that's going to take a couple of things. It's going to take us working through our own trauma, right? Kind of healing the trauma brain and the trauma response, developing what Daniel Siegel talks about when he says the response flexibility of a well-developed and wired brain. It starts with a sense of self in the parent, and this allows them to raise children who have a healthy sense of self, and really this comes from attachment. We value the whole self. We lean into the idea that Carl Jung talked about when he said, I would rather be whole than good. We embrace all aspects of the self and understand their value. That's what Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde was about, right? This idea that when we create this unnecessary binary, that we split the human, we split the psyche into two things that are not integrated and can become problematic. One of the most common forms of getting out of childhood alive, so to speak, in a defense, a resistance that we don't often talk about is compliance. Compliance and obedience come at a great cost often. Compliance comes often with depression, anxiety, substance abuse, and eating disorders. If one has to be good, if one has to worry themselves about their parents' disappointment or their parents being proud, if that's what they worry about, then it's going to be difficult for them at times. And while all children don't, there are many children who don't develop depression and anxiety and substance abuse disorders or eating disorders or mental health issues like these, we do see that the children that develop these are often medicating that critical voice inside of their heads that says that they're not measuring up. Like I said, we learn to value and welcome the anger that our children feel. We don't say things like, how dare you talk to me that way? And we start to become curious about what they're saying. We develop greater bandwidth. We value individuality. We even see the value in defiance and rebellion and going their own way. One of the things that they talk about when they talk about children that are in daycare is daycare values obedience and compliance because it's usually a group of kids with some adequate adult supervision, but the compliance is valued. And then when the child gets picked up by the parents at the end of the daycare day, the parent has limited emotional resources, so they overvalue compliance. So the child has no place to practice healthy defiance, healthy rebellion. There are two basic assumptions that we have at Evoke about parent work. And the first one is this: healthy attachment. This is something we subscribe to. If you want a reference, read the book Parenting from the Inside Out by Siegel and Hartzell. Healthy attachment is the greatest contribution that we can make towards our child's success and well-being. Providing a secure attachment to our child. That's the first assumption. The second assumption, borne out by exhaustive research in attachment theory, is that a parent's ability to understand and make sense out of their lives, to work through their own trauma, their own self-development, is the most important factor in determining whether they can provide a secure attachment for their child. So, healthy attachment is the best thing you can do, and working out your own, doing your own work is the best thing you can do to be able to provide that attachment. From Nurture Shock, the authors say, and it is emotional closeness, maternal warmth in particular, that is as close we get to a silver bullet against psychological impairment. Attachment, warmth, response, flexibility. Not about being good, not about getting it right, not about self-esteem that comes from the idea of being objectified as smart or talented, but a secure connection that can only be present when a parent has developed a sense of themselves. So what are the take-homes for this evening? It's your job to develop your own sense of self and serenity, not your child's. Right? In Al-Anon, we learn that. Your serenity is your responsibility. To do this successfully, you've got to work through some of your shame and guilt. You've got to make progress in that area and not let that be driving things. And that will allow you to be the bad guy because you won't need to be good anymore. But most of us grew up with the same kind of wound, that it was more important to be good than whole. That when our parents were upset or distressed or frustrated or anxious or worried or angry with us, that we were doing something wrong. So we grow up in a world just like the one that we pass on to our children without thought that it is a child's job to take care of a parent and their ego. Ideally, we learn not to use emotional expressions like sad, angry, and proud as behavioral methods for improving or modifying a child's behavior. It takes time. I think the difference between Evoke and what a lot of therapeutic programs might teach is the idea that this is a fundamental transformation. We believe in that idea that Joseph Campbell taught, that what the myths teach, what the great stories teach is about transformation. It's not a new skill or two, a new idea or two. It's not superficial change. It's understanding and developing a deep and completely different sense about what it means to be a person and what it means to love another person. And that's why some of the stuff, when parents first listen in on what I'm talking about and what we're teaching you about, they say it didn't make sense to me. But after you feel it, after you get a sense of it, you know exactly what I'm talking about. Allowing for struggle, allowing for mistakes, and being consistent with your goal to connect to your child and recognizing that that's the way for them to develop a sense of self. Managing your fear, your anxiety, and your trauma responses and developing response flexibility. It's a neurological repair that you do to yourself by the work that you do. So many people say, what's my work? Your work is to make sense of your childhood. I joke about this idea, but there's some truth to it, that when people tell me that they had a wonderful childhood, I tease them and say, well, therapy can fix that. Because nobody has a perfect childhood. And our wanting to cling to the idea that it was just good is neurotic. It's not sane. It had wonderful aspects to it, and it had painful aspects to it. And our willingness to look into it and our willingness to potentially betray the idea of familial loyalty with the idea that our parents and our child needed to be good or only good, our willingness to betray that is a really healthy thing. I have no investment. I do a lot of things wrong, but one of the things that I'm consistently improving on is this idea that there's no idea in this family that dad needs to be a good dad. We're very clear on that. Very comfortable on that. But what that does, when Dad gets to be a numbskull or an idiot, what that does is it allows me to be me. I get to have boundaries. And they don't have to come from a place of 100% confidence that I'm absolutely right all the time and that I know what's best for everybody else. I just get to have boundaries because they're mine. And since the project isn't me being good, I'm free. So those are some ideas. It's philosophical. But what our children are carrying around with them in so many ways is our anxiety, our worry, our expectations, right? We inherited them from our parents, they from theirs, and we pass them along to our children. But when we make our own differentiation, our own individuation, our own project, when we look at healing our own trauma and wounds, even if we experience no big T trauma, when we look at making sense of our world growing up, when we develop a daily practice and working on ourselves and our responses, when we shift the project from fixing the child to fixing ourselves, when we do all of that, we're much, much more capable of being there for the child so that when we interact with our child, it's not intrusive, but it's supportive. We have a psychological muscle, if you will, that we've developed where we can be there for them. And they don't need to be good or even healthy for us to feel okay. That they get to struggle, make stupid mistakes, and that we can be there for them. We can hold them in our minds with love and compassion and non-judgment. And when we can do that, it makes all the difference in the world. They walk around in the world with our voice, right? It's what we think and feel about them that becomes their inner voice. And so they walk around in the world, they are okay. That's what I talk to the kids about. That's what I talk to parents about. If children can escape childhood with a sense that they are okay, relationships are going to be better. Peer pressure is not going to be as impactful. Resilience is going to be improved. Pain, difficulty, loss are all going to be something that they can much more so go with and strive. Somebody asked the question about being the bad guy. Somebody says, a parent asks the questions, can you speak more about being the bad guy? You know, sometimes I think people think about it like being willing to just be the bad guy, like let your children dislike you. But I talk about this idea that when you've accepted that you're a flawed human being, you could just be you. Right? We have to do some healing. We have to escape the paradigm that most people that I've ever met and every culture that I've met have to believe that the goal is to be good. Therapists and psychologists don't think about the goal being good. They really don't. They think about the goal being authentic, real, and whole. That means you do some stupid things. You make some whoppers of mistakes. When I've worked with parents who have embraced a willingness to be the bad guy, they will say to their children, this is important. I'll use the example of going to a therapeutic school after Evoke. They will say, I don't know if it's the right decision. It's my best guess. If I'm honest with you, I stay up some nights and wonder if I'm doing the wrong thing. And there's a part of me that would want to talk you into the idea and sell you on the idea that I'm doing the right thing and that I know for sure that it's in your best interest. And I don't know. But it is my decision and this is my boundary. And I'm doing the best that I can. And if I make a mistake, I hope in spite of that you can figure it out. So you just talk about being human. You don't quote Brad, you don't quote the therapist, you don't quote the research, you don't quote your parent mentor, right? You don't prove and recruit people and evidence and statistics and research to show that you're right. You do that for your well-being, right? You consult with all of those people. When I talk to you guys, it's for you. 95% of what I talk and teach about is for you to feel okay. But don't quote me to them. Not if the goal is to sell them on something. You need to know what I'm telling you is true for you. It needs to resonate with you. But for them, they get to not like it. They get to think you're an idiot. It's the same idea as I talk about in The Journey of the Heroic Parent, where I say, accept that you're an idiot parent and your children won't argue with you. But I say in my work with families, in this way of thinking, you don't get to be right anymore. But you do get to be a person. You do get to be a self. And being a self is so much better than being right. So that's what I mean about being the bad guy. Write a bad letter. When parents get anxious about writing letters, I say, write a bad one. The key to writing a book is to write a bad first draft. If you're willing to write crap, you won't get writer's block. If you have to get it right, if you turn on the editing mind, the critical mind, it's hard to eke out even a page without stopping. So you learn to be you. And for me, therapy helps that. There's one place I get to go every week for 1 hour where I can't do it wrong. And the only thing that happens there is I get heard and understood. And having that for 1 hour a week for the past 21 years with the same person and 28 years overall means everything. Changes the way that I think. I can say I'm sorry. I'm better at losing. Right? Whenever my children point out that I need to be right, I always say to them, right? And this is me with 28 years of treatment. Think how bad it would be if I was untreated for this stuff. But I know the problem because I have some familiarity with it. One parent says, there's only so much time. What is more important, a parent's capacity and actualization or connection to our child? By the way, thank you for saying that. Thank you for asking that. First of all, you can make a difference even in the end. When my mother said to me a handful of years ago when I was driving her back to the airport, this is just a few years ago, and she said, I'm sorry you were too big for me and I didn't know what to do and I was overwhelmed. Right? She's in her 70s at the time she says it to me. I'm in my 40s. And it made a difference. It crystallized something I'd been learning in therapy for years. So it's never too late. Owning your stuff, owning your fallibility. Your question is, what's more important, a parent's capacity and actualization or connection with the child? One leads to the other. Right? I'll go back to that slide. I'm sorry for the typos on the slide, but the first principle that we believe is supported by exhaustive research and attachment theory is that healthy attachment, attunement to your child is the greatest thing you can do to contribute to their well-being and long-term success. And that can come only in as much as you've sorted out your life, made sense, looked at your own childhood, the messages, the ideas, the roles, the rules, critically. See, nobody grew up in a normal family, right? Every family has some crazy idea to it. So when you deconstruct that, when you discover and look back on it, you realize that wasn't the truth. That was just a truth, right? You learn that your life and the things you were taught weren't the absolute truth, but rather where it was just constructs, ideas, and your parents were doing the best that they can and they didn't know better. Some better than others. So the answer to the question is, what's more important? Work on yourself and your own actualization, individuation, differentiation, and that will allow you to contain, to relate to respond to your child in a much more secure way. Another parent asks, are we done with college? Should everyone do a gap year? I've already changed and evolved my choice of friends. My new friends are more authentic and less critical of perceived success. Thank you so much for saying that. Because yes, part of this is we have to pull ourselves out of the paradigm. You know, so many of our parents are from the Upper East Side of New York City and the North Shore of Chicago and Marin County and Orange County, California, where I grew up, right? The suburbs of New Jersey and Connecticut and Toronto, all on and on and on. Doesn't have to be those places, but these places where there's so much pressure. So yeah, part of it is you change, you evolve, and then you end up hanging out with different people who think differently. You end up, what I say is you find your people, and you know they're your people when they're not experts on your life. When they know that they don't know. When they know they're winging it too. When they know that even when it goes well, it can be hell and challenging. And nobody has the answers. And they can sit with you when you're going through your struggle without the knee-jerk impulse, right? Need to give you advice or solutions. That's when you know they're your people. Hang out with people that aren't experts on your life. Hang out with people that are comfortable not knowing what everybody else's journey. So it's not that everybody should have a gap year, but it's finding what works for the child. You know, I never really said to my children, you should go to graduate school or not. They just did. But I didn't have an opinion about them going or not. And my son, who's going, he'll go to some Ivy level school next year or not. He didn't have to. It was no rule. He just found it. He found that the bliss in learning. And when he went around to tour schools, he didn't choose an Ivy League school because he doesn't care about that prestige. In fact, that was off-putting for him. He chose a school that for him valued learning and even considered strongly schools that don't give grades because that kind of environment isn't good for him. And I'm not trying to sell you on one way of being. It's just learning to be with the child and develop a plan that works for them and have them create it. Somebody says it's such a shame that the culture in the affluent community in that its stakes are high from the get-go. In kindergarten, we want our kid in the highest reading group. Now that my child is a young adult, I really know about the high stakes. I feel like I'm doing it in reverse by being chill now, that they're doing very dangerous and unhealthy things. Isn't that the way that it learns, right? It's just so hard. And we really did think when we thought about preschool and kindergarten and private schools and the traveling soccer team, right? And the best voice lessons and you know, how much weight they're gaining and all the things that we thought, it was just our anxiety. We were just trying to do good because that's what we were taught. And there's no shame in that, right? We come to this through a flawed process, but our children and their symptomology are saying to all of us, this isn't working for me. I don't like this. I don't like what you're passing on, and I'm going to do it differently. And I've worked with a lot of you, and I've seen some parents make some amazing strides in their ability to develop what you described as this kind of chill response to things, right? And it's unfortunate that we had to learn it this way, but that's really what it comes down to, right? Is our children aren't here to learn from us. They're here to teach us in a lot of ways. So thank you for that. All of you, thank you for showing up. Just showing up to these is such a big thing for your children. The fact that I have a list of 40 or 50 people that would be willing to show up and listen to this live and ask questions and be taught and not know and be open to a different process and a fundamental shift is everything to your child. And when you shift from making them the project to fix to making you the project to fix, it removes so much heavy weight off of their shoulders. It helps them to lower their walls and defenses, right? When you lower your walls and defenses, they lower theirs in response. All right, I'll be in New York this Monday, 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. I'll be in Southern California in the South Bay, December 1st, 3:30 to 6:30. Contact Melanie at Evoke Therapy Program for more information. If you want to do a deep dive in your own work, I believe this is the best thing that can be done to help your child that you have power and control over, and that is your own intensive. We filled up October and November. Actually, October is done. November's filled up, and so our next opening is in December, December 11th through 15th, just open. And then the 2020 date. So if you possibly can, it's 4.5 days, and I can't think of anything better that you can do. It doesn't complete the project, but it definitely sets the course. Pursuit trips are for young adults or families who want sober fun or therapy light or reconnection. We ask all parents to try, just to try, at least 6 12-step support groups. Any combination of Al-Anon Coda or Families Anonymous. I think adult children is a great foray into a group that can help you look at if you came from an alcoholic or possibly a toxic family, it can help you look at the dynamics that are present there. Alateen is for teenagers. RefugeRecovery.org is a support group with a Buddhist emphasis, less of an emphasis on a higher power. NAMI.org, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, has chapters in your local area that you can go to and get free classes and resources. Follow all of these recordings on a podcast app on an iOS or an iPhone device. Use the podcast app. On an Android device, use the SoundCloud app. On your computer, go to soundcloud.com. On Twitter and Instagram, you can find us at Evoke Therapy Programs. You can find Evoke Therapy Programs by using the handle at Evoke Therapy. And you can find the Summit Lodge on Instagram using the Evoke Summit Lodge handle. On Facebook, you can find Evoke by searching Evoke Therapy Programs. The Alumni Foundation, by the way, we need new board members. If you have any interest, any experience in fundraising or the legal aspects of a nonprofit, or you're just passionate about giving back, this is an organization of alumni, families, parents who raise money to help people that can't afford therapy. Please reach out to the Alumni Foundation on Facebook by searching Evoke Family Foundation. The Evoke Therapy blog has new content each week. My book, The Journey of the Heroic Parent, is available on Amazon. If you use the Parent Alumni Foundation book page through the Amazon Smiles program, a percentage of the proceeds go to help people that can't afford therapy, like I said. Any last questions before I wrap up? I'm going to be in New York several days next week, so we're going to have a guest speaker. Judith Sidora is going to join us and be doing a webinar next week, so hopefully you can join her and hear what she has to say. She's a fantastic and passionate speaker. So thank you again, for and on behalf of your children, for joining us. I hope this is a helpful point of contact. Thank you for being willing to make your journey, your differentiation, a priority, and the difference that can make in your child's life. Take care. Bye-bye. No time.